begins our discussion of Yiftach part 3. And so let's just try a reframe of where we left off last time and just gives us a sense of the difficulty of what's going on over here. Yiftach has been the outcast. He's been the ostracized sibling, sent out, completely left behind. And that was the beginning of his life. Really, he was the child of another wife, of another woman, and whatever that meant, we discussed last week. And he has been sent to the as an outcast, and he goes to live in a land of Tov. And what we finished off by saying last time is that the Eretz Tov could mean that he's sending a place that he could even just be in a place that he's trying to evade even having to tithe his produce to come into Jerusalem, because he doesn't even have to. Have the encounter of his brothers were giving him a hard time even getting into the city of Jerusalem. Very difficult situation. And he gathers a collection of people called Anashim Rekim. That's these empty people. Now, just for echoes, if you want to hear the harmony of this in Tanakh, where else are there people in Tanakh who accumulate to themselves empty people? Or people who are bands of, we'll call it, rogues. When they're outcasts.
Was it where Lot lived?
Well, Lot actually, Lot found the people, he sort of settled among them. What I'm looking for is a magnetic person who has sort of charismatically gathers all these people.
Does
David? So, well, you're right. So now it happens to be that Dozen Aviram do gather a crowd by Korach, right. So that's interesting. So the thing is, you're right. They're very bad people, and he manages to somehow mobilize them. But the idea of like a person being an outcast and then sort of gathering people is described in more explicit terms by one person who's David HaMelech. When he's kicked out and he's in pursuit, it says that he has a band of people who don't fit in elsewhere. That's one example. And another example more recently was the end of last year's learning was a man by the name of Abimelech. He was a pretty bad person, right? He was the one who killed all his 70 brothers to take the kingship. And he had Anashim Rekim or Pochazim. Well, these Pochaz means, Reka means empty, and Pochaz means like unstable people. So he gathered a whole group of unstable people to himself, who sort of gravitated towards him, and he used them as his way of trying to kill his brothers and to establish his monarchy. Whereas David HaMelech somehow used that as his seat of gaining a certain sense of kingship of for the future, which is interesting. Right, so over here, when we see this happening, we need to think to ourselves: what model is Yiftach going to be? You know, is he going to be the David HaMelech model, and is he going to take this to catapult him into kingship, or is he going to be the Abimelech, who's also going to try to get it into kingship, but through a very villain-esque type of backdrop? So that's what we're left with. Now we're going to move on right now to Pasuk Dalet, and now we can try to imagine what the brothers must be thinking, because they need him now. Now he's proven to be a very effective and a leader for people. So it says the pasuk in pasuk Dalet on page 2. Vayihim yamim vayilachamu bnei Amon im Yisrael. And it was after days that Amon waged war with Israel. So if we're watching the director's cut over here of the scenes, what has happened was we were at the cusp of war. Ammon is gathering his troops. Israel's responding. The camps are building up and the tension's building. And then we reversed probably about 20 or 30 years to the beautiful birth of Yiftach, and then he's being kicked out. Now we're fast forwarding back to the scene. Okay, so we're back in the scene now, and now the war is about to happen. Vayhi in Pasuk Hey Kasher Nilchamu Bnei Ammon in Yisrael. So now they need him. Now what they're going to do is they're going to try to bring him back, because in the end of the day they need him. So they go. So they come to find him. Now you have to try to put yourself in their position. What are they going to possibly say now, which is going to now rectify years of bad blood? So they come and they come to take him away, and notice as well over here that the election process or the choice of the shofet is not one of Hashem, opening up the skies and the clouds parting, the music playing, and Hashem saying, "It is him." Right? What's happening over here? How's our shofet being found? Is through the actions and the initiative of people, which is an interesting thing. This is very much, we saw this dynamic beforehand, that people are asking God, who should we, well, they're thinking among themselves, who should we appoint? So it's now actually happening very in real time. Vayamru, so we return to Pasuk Vav. Vayamru liyiftach lecha v'hayisalanu lekotzin v'nilchamo b'vnei Amon. Come, why don't you become our what's katzin?
Katzin is in the army.
Right, katzin literally is a chief, or it's a military position. Become for us our military head. That's what his suggestion. Their suggestion is v'nilchamo b'vnei Amon. So what do they want from him at this point in time? Meaning, what is their request essentially?
He should lead them in battle.
Okay, now this is interesting because if we're to just reverse for one moment, okay, reverse for a moment to the previous Perek Pasuk Yud Ches at the top of the page. This is Perek Yud Pasuk Yud Ches, second from the top Pasuk of the page. Remember what they were looking for at the beginning. So we are the readers, so we have an advantage. We can now analyze the characters and see what they're really saying and what are they presenting. This is what they wanted. Yurches says, "Vayamru am sarin el Gilad ish el re'eyu." Okay, this is their conversation. This is before the board. This is the board meeting before they have the interviews. Okay, mia ish asher yachel yilachem b'vnei Amon yeh l'rosh l'chol yeshrei Gilad. What were they looking for now at the beginning? They were looking for a head. Now a head sounds a little more than a katzin. Okay, so you see what's happening over here. You see, this is negotiations that are going on over here. They were looking for a rosh. They obviously have not found anybody, right? Because that's why they're going to Yiftach. I mean, this is a very difficult thing for them to do. So they're going out. But what they've done is now they've minimized the job description, right? They've said, listen, all we want you to do is, it's almost like a consultant. They say we want you to fill the necessary position, which is the military element of it, and that's it. Meaning then once your consultation, once your degree of mercenary help has finished, goodbye. That's what it sounds like they're saying. So it's just good to focus on the language to see the change of motives and the deception, perhaps, or that perhaps they change the motives. So now Yiftach responds. Vayomer Yiftach, and Yiftach responds, and it sounds like in indignance. Lizikne Gilad, haloyatem sene semosi. You hate me. You kicked me out. So why do you want me when it's difficult for you? Right? Very understandable response. Very understandable response, right? Meaning you only need me at the point of your trouble. Now this is, by the way, you should just also appreciate this. These are his brothers in the end of the day, and they're being hunted down, right? They're in a very perilous place. You see the degree of pain that he must have gone through, meaning, you know, this could be a situation of life and death, but still, he's saying, you know what, you rejected me to the point that I don't even associate with you. That's how far he's going. You'll notice something interesting over here, just in terms of pattern, that if you reverse to what had happened in the previous perek, Israel rejected God. They kicked God out of the house, and they served all these other avodah zarahs, and then Hashem sold them into slavery for 18 years. And then at the end they said, oh, you know, God, maybe we can make up. And what did God say? God said, no, because it clearly wasn't sincere. And then they beseeched a second time, and what happens? Then God says, you know what, I hear you. You're going to see an interesting thing. That pattern is going to be repeated over here, but in the microcosm. What happened was, at the beginning was, they kick out Yiftach, right? They kick out their leader, and they say, we don't need you. And now when they need him, they come. And what does he say? Sorry, it's a closed door. You close that door, right? So you're going to see the same pattern mirrored in a smaller sense over here, to the degree that we get their sincerity, or they're at the place where the person that, or the being that they're beseeching is ready for them. So now listen to this. Listen very carefully to this sentence and what they're saying now. What are they going to say more than what they have possibly said up till now? They say the following: Vayomru, and they said Ziknei Gilad el Yiftach. The elders of Zik Gilad said to Yiftach, Lachain, therefore, ato shavnu elecho. That's why we return to you. For alachta imanu, and we have and you will go with us. V'nil chamta b'vnei Amon, and you will fight from in and amongst the children of Amon. V'yisa lanu l'rosh l'chol yashvei Gilad, and you will be to us as a head for all the inhabitants of Gilad. So what's happened now? Great, exactly, that backtrack. Now, you see, in all good bargaining, what has to happen is, this is the reason why it's so hard to bargain, is that both sides of a deal come in with a certain amount that one side's not prepared to go below and one side's not prepared to go above. And the negotiations are trying to feel each other out to the point where how far you can push the other side. What's happened essentially is that Yiftach has said, I'm not prepared to just do a mercenary job for you. I'm not prepared to just walk in, walk out, and do what, you know, basically do the dirty work and then be rejected again. What does he, what does he say? His closing that door has made them say, you know what? They've pushed back to their original request, which is, well, we know is their request because we've been in on the conversation at the beginning, and they want now a Rosh. Okay, now they're offering him the full deal, which is, by the way, a huge concession on their side, if you think about it. Think about how much of a concession this must be. They're not, right? This is their outcast who's becoming their leader, their Rosh now.
Well, you think Rosh is greater than a Katsin?
Yeah, I think so. I think Katsin only serves as a military element. Katsin is used in the military context. Rosh could be beyond that.
Okay. So, right, because think about it, a Katsin has to always go to the primary.
Well, in today's language, that's the way we use it, as very in military terms. I think as well, in the way that Tanakh uses it, because here's the deal. It is once the battle's over, then what happens, right? So a Katsin is then going to be, you know, the army officer on reserve, and he's going to be a tag along. Whereas a Rosh is always going to be a Rosh. He's always going to maintain that position. So here we have that we see that they've really amended their perspective in this, in order to be able to actually appease him. And so therefore says Yiftach vayomer Yiftach el ziknei Gilad. If you will return me, if you will return me to fight amongst Midian Ammon, then Asan Hashem Osam Lefonai Anochi Lochem LeRosh, and God will give this nation to me, then I will be to you as a Rosh. Now, has he changed the requirements over here? Has he changed what they've said? This is because remember, here's the fine tuning of this deal. Has he changed what they said? Look at the way they said it.
He has to go home with them. Like, so home would mean that he is accepted.
Right. So where do you see acceptance in this autumn?
Where it says bring me back home to fight with the children in tech. Right? Is that it?
Right, so you're saying that it's not just fighting, it's actually bringing me.
Not just the place, but maybe bringing them back into the fold of the family, into being accepted. Maybe that word can have that kind of...
Right, so you're saying it's the tshuva, in a certain sense, the real homecoming of himself, which is a word he's added in to the process. Right, so meaning it's real homecoming, which is what he's demanding. It looks like.
This is probably going to explain why I never did well in Jewish subjects. I didn't get that part. I got instead that he was saying here that he will be the leader, the Rosh, but he will also fight with them. I thought that was something more, actually. He's willing to commit to being a leader and a fighter, which are really two things that they need.
Right. I mean, I think that they want him to do that. In Ches, it sounds like they want both of those still. Meaning that they did say, "V'alachta imanu v'nilcham tov b'nei Ammon." We want you to fight, and you'll be to us as a head. Not sure. It sounds like they did want those things. I just do one of the things that might be worthwhile considering is when he's becoming the head. Meaning, according to them, what was the way they presented this? At what point in time is he going to become the head? When?
Well,
it sounds like afterwards. Meaning, it sounds like it's like sequential. Meaning, you will fight, and then you'll come home as the leader. Right? Not clear when he says it. It might be that he's actually demanding leadership. When? It might be Anochi Eyeh Lachem LeRosh. This might be actually even now. Right? I mean, Yiftach might say that. Don't make my success contingent upon the battle. Not clear if that's a possible.
Meaning if?
Yes.
I think it sounds to me like he's totally repeating it. I don't think that he's. Otherwise, it would have said Rosh first. He put it over at the end.
I hear that. I've heard people who have suggested that what he's trying to do is he is the Ehyeh Lachem LeRosh is really from now on inwards. But again, I don't know if it's the most. If it's the most necessary read of this, possibly,
right?
He should have possibly said this first.
Point well taken.
At the same time, I think that Orton's point does remain, which is that he has inserted the word Meshivim Osi, that he does want to return. He wants real acceptance over here. So that we're just trying to do a clear, careful read of how he's responding. Vayomru ziknei Gilad. And now in Pasuk Yud, he says, El Yiftach Hashem Yiyeh Shomea Beinoseinu Im Lo Yechid Varcha Kein Naaseh. So therefore, what do they say? They say Hashem will be the listener between us if we don't do what you say. So what's God's involvement over here? Why are they evoking God?
The witness.
God's a witness, really, right? They're saying, look, to the degree that we all trust in God, and we know that God's watching us, so we are responsible to Him, therefore to you. Okay? So they take this hook, line, and sinker. They're either in a very, very tight corner, which it seems like they are in,
yes.
Or they also, all this has also made them think again about their priorities. So either way, or perhaps the balance of the two, has led them to this.
Isn't it also possible in here, because they basically said, if you go into battle and Hashem brings you victory, and they said that in the last pasuk, so here, maybe they're invoking Hashem's name, basically saying, God, since
that's interesting.
You're taking part of it, for sure you're going to now give us the victory because you're now the witness.
That's a very interesting point.
What he was beforehand.
That's a very interesting part. Meaning, in a certain sense then, in a certain sense...
forcing Hashem's hand, but in the wrong way.
Because they're saying that Hashem is going to be the testimony to this deal, therefore they're sort of depending on God to actually bring this big victory about so that they can listen to Him, right? So that's what Lynn's saying over here. And you notice that because he himself evoked Hashem. He said, look, Hashem's going to be the one to lead me into battle, so that perhaps what he's saying over here is, they're saying is they're trying to evoke God over here. It's a win-win, right? I mean, everybody's going to gain out of this kind of situation. And therefore, finally, we conclude the section by saying, "Vayelef yichtach im ziknei Gilad," and he went with them, with the elders of Gilad. Vayasimu aham oisai aleihem larosh ulekatzin. Vayaber yichtach as kol dvarav lifnei Hashem amitzpah. So, what do they place him as? They both them as both a head and a katzin. Okay, so as their spiritual leader and as their military leader, and Yiftach spoke all his matters in front of Hashem in mitzpah. Now, you see a lot of very interesting things over here. First of all, they didn't make it on the base of the battle, right? At the beginning, it was going to be if you succeed, then you come back, you can take the wreath, and you get the chair, the throne, and the whole business. Now, over here, it sounds like from the beginning he's already in power. Very a very interesting point, number one. And also, obviously, you got both parts of this. Let me just ask you, what do you think about this? Who is negotiating? It's Yiftach and whom? Who's the other party over here?
The elders of Gilad.
Yeah, so where's his brothers? Meaning his brothers were really the antagonists over here.
Right.
So where were his brothers in this entire passage? Did they disappear along the way? What happened to his brothers? Not clear, right?
They're not mentioned.
They're not really mentioned. So a number of them before Shem, I think if I'm not mistaken, the Malbim suggests over here that his brothers were in and amongst the elders of Gilad. They were the people who were in charge, which is why when they came back to him and they said, you want to come back? He says, but you kicked me out and now you want me, meaning you as in literally you, because they were the leaders. They became the leaders of Gilad. Remember that Yiftach's father's name is Gilad. He was obviously a prominent family in the area. His father had the name of the place. So it stands to reason that his brothers were among them. But even let's say that his brothers weren't in the picture. Let's say his brothers were the proletariats. They weren't really part of this whole negotiation process. But what Yiftach is saying is he's holding accountable the whole system, the whole jury, the whole way that society runs. And he says, look, you as a society didn't cry foul when I was kicked out. And therefore, I'm going to hold you as a society responsible to the point that you actually take responsibility. Either which way, there's a peace made at least between him and the elders of the society, if not even his brothers himself. Which is actually a very nice thing to see in Tanakh, because a lot of times you're going to see that as we get so certainly into later Shmuel, that the revenge cycles it becomes a widening gyre, right? It keeps going bigger and bigger. So over here, we actually managed to overcome that. So now we have Yiftach as our leader. So remember, and now, so what's the first thing he's going to do as a leader? He actually is a very proud and very strong leader. His first response is the following. Vayishlach Yiftach malachim el melech b'nei Amon leimor. He sent messengers to the king of Amon saying, Maliv aloch ki vaso elai lilachem barzi. What's going on over here? Why are you fighting on my land? So there's a lot of things to take note over here. First of all, is his first action military? Is the first thing he's looking at is a good war?
It's
political. So he's obviously exercising diplomacy at the beginning, which is an interesting way that he starts off this whole episode. The Midrashim learn from here that what's called Gadol HaShalom, that we try as much as we can to create peace, mm-hmm. even though it may seem like a situation which is not going to diffuse, and he's right. But at the same time, we try to reach out and see what we can. Another interesting thing to notice over here is pronouns. Who which pronouns is he using when it relates to his country?
It's me.
It's personal pronoun, right?
Right.
Do you notice that? You notice something interesting over here? This is such an interesting thing. Up till now, you can imagine that Yiftach has had an identity crisis, right? He's born in Gilad, he was raised in Gilad, his father, whose name was Gilad, he was kicked out, and he was the only people who adopted him were these empty people in Syria, right? And then he's brought back in. So who is Yiftach? The answer is that whatever personal turmoil he must have been going through, at the point that he gets back here, who does he identify with? His land. Okay, so you see something, you see obviously whatever else was going on in his head, he's now got laser beam certainty as to what his goals are. And therefore, as a representative, he's a very strong representative, and he talks as if he is the manager of the company, and he is, and he says, what are you doing in my land? My land meaning everybody else I'm representing. So the Ziknei Gilad are his, part of his me, his I consciousness now. Very interesting to the degree that he identifies us. Now, Melech Ben Ammon is not going to be pacified just quite so easily, and he says the following. In Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayomer Melech Ben Ammon El Malachei Yiftach. So Melech Ben Ammon, the king of Ammon, says to Yiftach's messengers, Ki lakach Yisrael es arzi ba'alo asiri b'mitzrayim, me'anon v'ad yabok v'ad yardein v'ad to'a shivo esen b'shalom. So he's, look, I'm not trying to create problems over here. It's just like, you know, a few centuries ago, you and your children took my land from me. So, you know, if you want peace, then, you know, all you need to do is to return stolen lands.
Oh my gosh.
Right. Now, unfortunately, when I was reading the comments in one of the New York Times articles today, and some of the comments were, you know, it's so hard to see these kind of things happen. But this is what happens if you steal other people's land. They become desperate. You know, you see the twisted nature of how twisted history becomes reality. Now, we're going to have to actually analyze this because he's making a claim. He's making a very bold claim. That claim is that the land was stolen from him. Was it stolen from him? We have to see. We have to take a look at history to see if this is actually true. He claims that Israel took his land. Where does Ammon live, by the way? Ammon is a which bank of the Jordan kind of person? He's an East Bank person, correct. So Ammon, if you just take a quick look and let's see which map is easier for this one. Yes, page 14 is pretty clear. Okay, so the very last page, and they both have it, but it's 14, the very top right corner, on the east bank of the Jordan is Ammon, is vertical over there on the top right corner. Can you see over there? So it's right next to the land of Gilad, just above the Dead Sea, the Yam HaMelech, which is that darker area. So he claims that what must have happened, that Israel took that land. When would they have taken that land? When is this claim?
When they came out of Egypt.
Right. So now remember, when they were in Egypt, they spent a lot of time in the lower desert, in the southern desert of Paran and Sinai, and then they would circle around to the top, and they came around the side. And when they eventually settled down to come into the land, which is in Bamidbar to Devarim, Sefer Bamidbar to Sefer Devarim at the end, they came in through the east, just above the Yam HaMelech, which is that area of Bnei Ammon. Right. So they claim that their cities were taken, or just a little further higher actually than that. And they claim that their cities were taken at such point, and that's why they need to be reestablished in their position. So now, I don't want to get too technical on Yiftach's response. I want to read it through just as one monologue quickly, and then reconsider the different points that he's saying, and then reconsider history. Okay, so let's just try to get one long speech that Yiftach is responding to. So he says the following in Yud Daled, okay, and we're gonna have to try to keep mental track as we read through this very quickly. How many arguments Yiftach is actually making? It's not one coherent argument. So he continues. He tries hard. He sends messengers. So says Yiftach, Loi lakach Yisrael es eretz Moab es eretz b'nei Amon. We did not take it. Ki ba'losam b'mimisraim, when we ascended from Egypt, vayelech Yisrael b'amidbar ad Yamsuf vayavok Kadesha. We came to to Yamsuf, the Reed Sea, and we went to Kadesh. Kadesh is a city on the southeast border of Israel. Vayishlach Yisrael malachim el melech Edom leimor, ebrono ba'artzecho, v'loi shama melech Edom. And we sent messengers to Edom, to the city of to the country of Edom, and they didn't let us through. And we weren't able to, so we went to Kadesh. Let us just see what he is saying over here. You just turn back to the map for a second. This is very helpful to see what's going on over here. You can imagine that Israel's coming along the right-hand side of this picture, okay? On the right-hand side, which is the east-hand side of the picture, and they're starting at the bottom, and they're trying to find access leftwards, westwards into Israel. So the nation that they bump into first at the end of their stay in the desert is Edom, right? That's in the sort of central area of the picture of the map is Edom, which is sort of the gateway into Israel. Doesn't let them in. For whatever reason, Hashem says, don't attack them. Hashem says, you know what? The Midrashim explain and go into the reasons why we weren't allowed to attack Edom. They're essentially our brother. And then they went upwards further they try to get through Moab and Ammon, which are the two further ones before. And what happened over there? Both of them refused. And again, Hashem also told them not to. Now, interestingly enough, there was a certain sense of brotherhood there as well, because where do Ammon and Moab come from? Where the nations descended from? They're from Lot, right? Which is the nephew of Abraham. So they're really also part of the general family. So what did Israel finally do? Where did they finally go to? They went further up, which is not in this map, but it is a little further north to the land of Sichon and Og, which is like around the area of the right of the Kinneret. If this map extended a little further north, around the area of the Kinneret on the east. That area was Sichon and Og, and that's where they conquered, and that became their way of entering into the land of Israel. Okay, so what's Yiftach saying right now? Just out of interest, what's the argument he's making? Yes, we didn't attack you, right? We didn't attack you. We were attacking the. We tried you. We knocked on Edom's door, Moab's door, and Ammon, but you said no. We left you alone and we went north. Great. So that's what it sounds like you're saying over here. Let's go back to Pasuk Yud Ches. Vayelech b'amidbar v'yosef es eretz Edom v'es eretz Moav v'yavon mizrach shemesh l'eretz Moav v'yachanun be'ever Arnon v'lo bo b'gvul Moav ki Arnon g'vul Moav. We went further to the north of Moav and we didn't enter. We just stood by the city there, which was Arnon, which was by part of Moav. Yotes v'yishlach Yisrael malachim el Sichon melech Emori melech Heshbon v'yomer loy nabronol ha'tzachol makomi. Then we send messengers to Sichon, which was an Amorite king. He wasn't one of the family of the Abrahamic dynasty. And they said, look, we need to get back to our place. Can you let us through? V'lo yamin Sichon is Israel. Avor b'gvuloi. And Sichon did not believe or did not allow them to let them go through his land. V'yayasof Yisichon is kol amoy. V'yachanu b'yotzov yilochem im Yisrael. And he actually brought his army out to fight with Israel. These are all recorded in Parshas Chukas. V'yitan Hashem Elokei Yisrael is Sichon mele v'es kol amoy b'yad Yisrael. V'yakum v'yirash Yisrael is kol eretz amori yoshev b'ereha eretz ahi. And Israel, in response, in retaliation to this, to their army coming out, decimated them. They acquired all that area, which was Amorite territory on the east. Meaning, we conquer that land. What, you want to conquer the land that we got from the Amorites? Not you? Haloi es asher yorishecho kamosh elohecho oiso tirosh ve es asher yorish Hashem Elokeinu miponenu oiso nirosh. That which kamosh, which is your God, gave you, keep. With that which God, our God, gave us, we keep. Very simple, right? By the way, if you go back in the records, we do have things like the Mesha Stili and certain like archaeological records of what Moab and Ammon were talking about in those days. And the Kamosh was their big deities. So he says, you know what? You keep yours, we keep ours, but that was what we got. Vato hatov tov ato mi balak ben sipor melech Moav harov rov im Yisrael im nilchom nilcham bom. Are you better than Moav who tried to fight against us? Did Balak succeed? Did Balak succeed when he tried to fight against the Jews? He did not, right? He was thwarted. He tried to rent Bilam, and that didn't work out so well. B'sheves Yisrael b'cheshbon v'vnosel v'aror v'vnosel v'chol he'orim asher al yedei amyar arnon shlosh me'oz shana umadur lehitzaltem bo'ayisahi. He says, and look, Israel's been sitting in Cheshbon and all these cities around it for centuries. So if you had an issue then, what should you have done? You should have filed a complaint long ago.
Right.
Right? There is a limiting clause over here as to how long it's really appropriate to start filing complaints. I did not sin to you. You are the wrongdoer by fighting against me. Yishpot Hashem haShofet hayom bein bnei Yisrael veinu bein Amon, and Hashem should judge between me and you and the children of Ammon. Okay, so that is Yiftach's speech. It's quite a long speech. Let's try to identify the arguments that Yiftach is making over here when he responds to Sichon. What's the first thing that he's saying?
He's
quibbling at this point in time on the facts. Meaning, he says, you took our land, and Yiftach's response is, we didn't take your land. Let's get back to that in a moment. What are the other elements that he also throws in his argument over here? There's really essentially four things he says. The first one is about attack. The first one is certainly the bigger of all of them, but there's a few other elements over here.
They didn't really attack, they asked permission to cross the land.
Okay, but I think that's you're right. But that's basically saying we didn't attack you, meaning
right.
Okay. We only attacked other people then, really.
Maybe in Chashim, where he talks about, he says, I don't know if they that it was God's will.
Okay, so it sounds like there's more of a theological, religious argument, which is, right, which is meaning, you accept that when your God conquers, it's good. So accept that when our God gives us, it's also good. Meaning that's more of a religious argument rather than a territorial argument. Right? That's what it sounds like as well. That's argument number two. And essentially, you know, good fences make good neighbors, so goodbye, really. Right? That's what he's saying. But then he throws in another two interesting sort of afterthoughts. Another one is?
Balak.
Right? Now, why is he quoting Balak out of all the kings who tried but didn't succeed? Why is Balak the example of the person he chooses as a what? He was pretty famous, but also remember that Ammon and Moab are sisters. They're sistering nations. So what he's doing is he's picking an example, a famous example, from something they're familiar with. Meaning they just need to read the annals of their history to realize that they've tried this beforehand and it didn't work out. So he's throwing up the warning flag. Meaning just remember, go back into your history, right? Because as Moab and Ammon have a joint history. And finally, the last argument, which is a very good argument, is about
statute of limitations.
Meaning, it's clear that the issue here over here that at hand isn't land, right? Because if it was land, you should have talked up a long time ago. It's clear there's something else going on over here. You are having very ambitious ambitious land perspectives over here. You want to expand your territory. That's why you're talking. It's not about a real founded claim, right? So in Yiftach's small speech over here, we have four points. First of all, you're wrong about the facts about the attack. We asked your permission, we didn't attack you. Then God gave. Number three is, what about Balak? Remember your history, what happened when you last time you tried this? And then finally, the statute of limitations. Why did you wait so long? What I'd like to focus on is historically, what actually happened? Meaning, Ammon is saying, you took the land, Yiftach is saying, we didn't take the land. So why is there room over here? Why does time at this point in time give us the space to make this mistake? So actually there's a very interesting reason why this claim has been made. And this is very, very apropos today. I just want to just read it with you very, very briefly. Let's see where I put it in. Actually, you know what? I actually did not put it into the source books. But let me just say it out loud. This is at the end of Parshas Chukas, where this actual event is described in the Torah. It's so interesting to compare Nach and Torah and sort of put everything in one place. So what happens is that as is being described in Yiftach, the nation of Israel is trying to get access to the land of Canaan. They try in the corner with Edom, and then they try with Moab and Ammon, and they finally get to Sichon, and they conquer. And after they conquer, what happens is, there's a very interesting speech given about the history of Sichon and Og. Now, you're thinking to yourself, why do I need Amorite history? Meaning, why do I need to know the tribal history of the Amori? But there's an interesting point that he makes. He makes a point that Sihon, who was the king of the Amorites, conquered southwards into Ammon and Moab territory up to the area of Cheshbon, and he conquered it from them. And therefore, the Torah says, he cleansed it. Now, what does it mean he cleansed it? From the Torah's perspective, was Israel allowed to conquer Ammon and Moab?
No.
No, right? We are barred from the access to them. But what happened to the land that Sihon and Og conquered from Ammon and Moab? That became now Sihon and Og's land. Therefore, when the Jews conquered the land of the nation of Israel, conquered it from Sihon and Og, whose territory were they really getting was Amorite territory. But historically speaking, what are Ammon and Moab saying? They're saying
that was our
territory. Were they right? They were right. It was before it was taken by their conquerors. What's happening over here is a misappropriation of who did the conquering. They're thinking back over here and they're saying, look, we remember our grandparents' names are written on the arch as you enter the city. And the answer is, yes, you're right. But it was conquered by, not us, but Sihon and Og. So all you need to do is throw in a few centuries. And unfortunately, a lot shorter, as we've seen recently. And what you can do is you can really twist history in such a way that now the innocent, well, in this case, Israel were defending themselves and conquering Sihon and Og, become now the plunderers and become the evildoers. So you see, this is just such a fascinating perspective on history. You know how far is scope, or how do you confuse history? What kind of perspective do you have on history? They are right, it was their city, but did Israel take it from them? Not at all. It was Sihon, and they took it from Sihon. Okay? And this is very fascinating. Also to throw into this mix, and you have to also ask yourself how final is war? That's another thing which you have to ask over here is, it seems like in modern history, when one country conquers another, for a lot of nations we give that credence and say, well, you own it now. But it seems like in the context of certain countries like Israel, it's always deemed as occupation as opposed to conquest. Right? So part of that you also have to question is, what is Ammon thinking over here in the end of the day? Let's say it was real conquest. So the answer was, it's conquest, not occupation. That's what Yiftach is saying, is the statute of limitations is, in the end of the day, you may be right that we took it from you, maybe. But in the end of the day, we've been here for a very long time. It's clear this is not occupation, this is actual living. And it's the fighting, it is right, which seems to be fought throughout the history, which is, by the way, when we learn Tanakh, that's why it's so beautiful, is Tanakh is speaking to us all the time. Mm-hmm. And whatever is codified the Dorot for all the generations. And we can see it as it speaks to us here.
Doesn't this kind of remind you of the art from World War II that was taken? And then everything going on today with trying to get that art back.
And who really owns it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. But I think this would be such an interesting class just in itself.
Just to think about this politically today. But now to throw in, unfortunately, another part of modern Jewish history is the last pasuk for today, which is pasuk Chav Ches. What was the Melech Ammon's response? He didn't listen to him. Now think about this for a second. This is so fascinating. I was reading through the Abar Banel, Rav Yitzchak Abar Banel, and he says such an interesting thing. It wasn't that he was disregarding his arguments. You know what he was doing? Think about this. Here you have this established king on the East Bank who's got an army, he's got power. And along comes this new man. Walks into town yesterday, and today he is busy sending me these very strong letters. What does he do? He burns the letter. Why is he burning the letter? Not because he disagrees with the letter, but what's he essentially saying? He's discrediting Yiftach as a leader. He's saying, who are you to represent anything? Meaning, it's not that he's not listening to Yiftach. He's not listening to anything Yiftach has to say because he's discrediting him as a leader. You have to think about what this means in terms of also today. Meaning, there might be leaders who represent the greatest truths that there are. Meaning, you listen to his four arguments, it resonates, it makes a lot of sense. But what's he saying? I don't care. Because you don't exist, you're not on my radar screen. Yiftach's going to prove him very, very, very fairly wrong in this battle. But at this point in time, it's again something to think about, is what's going on. And the comment to the Abar Banel is so true today in our administration, as we know it. So looking forward to continuing next week. Next week, we can actually jump straight into the battle in the Neder. And then, which is going to be much, much, there's a lot to talk about over there. And then the following week, we're going to delve into the Civil War afterwards. So this is really now things are really on the cusp.